This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with James Ernest. He is a board game designer, founder, and president of Cheap Ass Games. He is best known for games including Diceland, Enemy Chocolatier, Kill Dr. Lucky, and a lot more. Ernest, great talking to you.
Hi, how are you?
And I'm all great, and I'm also joined here with my co-host, Pilator.
Hey, James, I'm a huge fan of your games.
Oh, great, thank you.
So you were a juggler before you were a board game designer. Can you
talk about that
transition?
I was just juggling with my friend Nate that's still on my resume, because it's been a while since I had to update my resume.
Yes, even your Wikipedia page says that too, board game designer.
Oh man, this is a shout out to anybody who likes editing Wikipedia pages. I hate my Wikipedia page. Somebody needs to fix that thing. But yes, I was a professional juggler. That's the kind of profession where you have to say professional before it. From when I was in college to just after I moved to Seattle and fell into game design. So about 5 years of my life.
Can you talk about your history with game design? What originally got you interested in game design? Were you always interested in board games? And
I would say that I was always interested in board games. I did a very formal design project when I was in high school. I was writing a fantasy novel, and the one of the core story elements was a board game that sort of came to life. And the novel didn't get done, but the board game got lots of testing and variations written and very, clear rules and a whole history written for it. So that sort of proves that I was meant to be a game designer. But I got into the business of it when Magic the Gathering came out, or actually just before, because I had a lot of friends who worked at Wizards. And so I got to watch that game get its pre-Kickstarter fundraising done and see its first release and how hard it was and how interesting it was to publish games in that time. So that's 1993 would be when I actually got into the business.
Magic, and then you started your own company.
Yeah, that's right. About 3 years later, I started Cheap Ass Games because I had a lot of game designs built up at that point and had a little bit of experience with self-publishing. I'd done a juggling book already, and I was just could not figure out any way that I could sell all those games into the board game industry as an unknown. So I started up my company to sort of be a release valve for those products.
I actually first found out about your games. I think it was, I still go to board gaming night, and I think the game that I really started to enjoy, I think was one of those cheap ass game paper. I think it was Fight City. It was just this very old game, and I kind of liked it. It was very minimalistic. And then all of a sudden I seen those reissued games. I think the new edition of Unexploded Cow I got into, and I really enjoyed this kind of throwing of the dice and like minimalistic style. And then I noticed you have a certain personality in your games, or minimalism.
Yeah, and I think it's getting even more acute. I think I've taken a look at rock, paper, scissors, and I might be able to get it down to just rock and paper. Like, my design sensibility has gone so far to the simple. I like designing casino games, really easy entry stuff. And I'm really getting frustrated with the sort of large point salad procedurals that everyone else in the gaming industry seems to love, but I just don't have the patience for them anymore. So yeah, Unexploded Cow is a good baseline project for us. That's not super complicated. It does take 30 minutes or so to play, but it's super easy to learn, and all the turns are very simple, and you get to play a lot more than sort of try to figure out the rules.
I like at the end of the game where you just have to kill all the cows by exploding them and you get as much. I just find that very funny in a way. Cows left and right, and it becomes interesting where it's all a money game and betting and killing things. I think it's very silly and funny. Kind of like, I recently got into Fish Cook too. I found that a very interesting game, and I want to believe it's some kind of foreign game as well.
Right. Yeah. Fish Cook has, among other things, a completely fake backstory. Because the game is about being a chef, but the game is also about being an artist and ripping other people off and getting ripped off and having your ideas stolen. and deciding whether it's better for you to make up your own stuff or steal from other people. And so the backstory of the game is like a version of that. Like the game was published in France 100 years ago, and then there were a whole bunch of, you know, knockoff games in the 50s and 60s, and then there was this straight up copy that was done by a Japanese company, and we have the rights to that. And you know, all of that is made up. And there was this great brief moment at Gen Con a couple of years ago where a Japanese partner of ours was thinking about licensing it, and I said, oh please, you know, let us do the US edition of the Japanese translation, blah 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 blah.
With your games, would you say it's more about the narrative than the mechanisms of the game?
I've made a lot of games, but generally the answer to that is yes. I want to know what I'm pretending to do. And strictly from the design to player standpoint, the player knows what he's supposed to do if the story helps him remember. And I've played lots of games where either there is no story and all the rules just seem random, or worse yet, where the story implies that I'm going to do something and that what the game tells me to do something else. I just feel like, as a designer, it's easier for me to tell you half the rules if I just tell you what you're pretending to do. And on the other hand of the half of the coin, as a publisher, I need to know why someone's going to pick up my game and read the box. And a funny story is my, you know, quick hook into that. I've very rarely had an opportunity to make an abstract game because I don't know how to sell it. And so TAC, which is the game from the Patrick Rothfuss series, is a great standout for us because it does have a story. It's a story people already know. And it isn't a story that's retold in the game, but it's a story that the game is a part of. And that's a great opportunity to make something classical.
Do you think that coming up with a strong narrative is more challenging than coming up with rules for a new game?
I do, 100%. I think the story is harder than the rules. And I think you'll see that throughout the hobby game industry, there are not a lot of stories that aren't reminiscent of other stories in the hobby game industry. Like, you know, there's zombie games and space combat games and cowboy games and Egyptian games. And the stories rarely go much deeper than that. So I think in many of these cases, there was a game that was about something else or about nothing. And a publisher said, well, I would rather it was about this, and sort of changed the theme at the last minute. I try not to make games where you can even do that. But I also try to make stories that are a little more different, a little more compelling. And obviously that's not always true. Sometimes my stories are silly, but they're always like the starting point for the design. The mechanics are easy. They're like parts of a car. I don't really worry about what my mechanics are going to be. I rarely start there.
Your game, Kill Dr. Lucky.
Yeah.
That is based on, as a parody on the game, Clue. Can you explain how it's different than Clue? And what is the narrative of that game?
Well, I'll say it's indirectly inspired by Clue. I think it's inspired by the Victorian murder mystery genre in general. And the story of Kill Dr. Lucky is summed up in the title. Everybody wants to kill Dr. Lucky. The murder victim is still alive, and everyone's in his house at a dinner party. And the conceit is that you think you're the only one who wants to kill him, and so you have to try to do it when no one else can see you. So everyone's chasing him around his house and finding good places to hide and trying to kill him, and he's called Dr. Lucky because he's very lucky and he's hard to kill. So you will try many times and fail many times. It's sort of like a murder by death or a clue or a murder on the Orient Express or whatever, you know, type of setting. But yeah, in terms of the mechanics, there is nothing in common with the board game Clue except that they both have boards.
Are you supposed to play the game before Clue as to murder Dr. Lucky and then forwardly find out and then play a game? I always thought that was interesting, that it's kind of the opposite of Clue where you are a murderer, you know?
We have better games to play after Kill Dr. Lucky. We have a variant called Escape from Lucky Mansion where Dr. Lucky actually comes back to life and everyone keeps their positions from the end of the game and Dr. Lucky chases them around and kills them all. So, like, that's a better game to play right after.
Okay.
But yeah, again, I, you know, it's easy to compare the two, but I don't think that they are meaningfully related. Is that a fair way to say it?
I see.
Clue confuses me because I know it's hard to write a mystery game where there's not actually an AI, but like you can be the murderer and not know it and then win by finding it out.
And with these games, some of them are narratives that you make up, and then some of them are based on existing novels.
True. Most of them are mine. There are a few that are based on very well-known IPs with the serial numbers shaved off, and then every now and then I get to work with a partner who's got a license like Patrick Rothfuss and the Kingkiller Chronicles, and recently I'm working with Sonia Liris and her The Seer novel. She's writing a sequel to that novel, and we're creating the game that will be part of that.
What about I've always been interested, but the new game TAC, I see that. I kind of want to pick it up, but I'm not familiar with the novel series of that game, and I kind of briefly looked it up online. It seems to be a game that was written in the book series, but then you guys imagined it. Can you explain more about the game TAC and what's it about?
Well, so TAC is described in Patrick Rothfuss's book, The Wise Man's Fear, and it's explained in very broad terms. They could be playing Go, but the main character meets a mentor who teaches him about the rules of a particular court in a particular place. And one of the things that he learns in this place is this game called TAC. Patrick's a gamer too, and he's really smart about how he writes about games. And so he did not really explain anything, like even lines like he beat me in 7 moves, he beat me in 10 moves, things like that. He took out of the book because they would be too specific and they would tie him down too much if he actually ever decided to finish inventing that game. So in the book, it's just described as a 2-player abstract where players place stones on a board. And like I said, it could be Go, it could be, you know, a Chinese checkers or chess kind of a thing, or all kinds of possible games could sort of exist in that space. So that was the design challenge, is to come up with a new game that has a court, sort of a nice courtly feel, a nice pre-industrial strategy game feel. And that's what TAC is. We have a game about building roads where you're placing stones on the board and also moving stacks of stones and spreading them out like a Mancala move, stacking pieces on top of other pieces and making taller stacks and more powerful, interesting stacks. But the game is basically about connecting opposite sides of the board. And when you make the road, you win.
Are you familiar with the Star Wars game Djarik?
No, I am not.
Do you remember in Star Wars 1 where they said let the Wookiee win and the holograms are on that
table? Oh, okay. Yeah, I just don't know what it's called. So yeah, that's
People have been making theories about how to play that game, and some actually try to play Djarik, and it's very
strange. Yeah, and it's lots of that one's sort of a chess-ish, more like a chess game. Now that I know what you're talking about, it's a round board with
hologram creatures.
Not a lot of spaces. It's got like 16 spaces, maybe, and a whole bunch of different creatures that obviously move around and, you know, attack each other. I think in episode 7 they like bump the table and it picks up right where the old game left off.
Yeah, I think I've seen that. I remember that.
Yeah.
With the inspirations for your game, do you have any funny stories of how you got inspired?
Well, I mean, the games themselves are funny stories, but I mean, like, Unexploded Cow was just a bunch of guys sitting around telling jokes in the bar. That's where a lot of these games come from, is like, wouldn't it be funny if, and eventually some of them turn into good starts for games.
Kind of like,
we did this today.
I'm sorry.
Well, they're not landmines, they're unexploded ordnance. The landmines are in Cambodia. These
no,
are...
I said Landyland. It's like this...
Oh, Landyland. Oh, yeah. So Landyland is a really weird outlying game. It's a multi-track racing game that is powered by Magic land cards. This is back in a time when land cards were ubiquitous because they came in starter decks, they came in booster packs, they came in everything, and you just had an infinity of these things, and what are you supposed to do with them? So we made a game that requires like a stack of 60 of each of those cards, and made it into a poster that we could give away at conventions. And we got permission from Wizards. We actually did 2 games. We did Landyland, which had a beautiful big spiral color board that's illustrated by Phil Folio. And we did another game called Mana Burn, which is more like a Monopoly track. It's kind of a snaking track that covers a lot of spaces. And that one you play with a deck of miscellaneous common cards, which of course, by at this point, each one of them would probably be worth $20. But back then, they were as common as grass.
How important is the visual imagery and aesthetic design of the games? Do you put most of the input into that, or do you hire people to do that and you work as the art director?
Well, I'm the art director and graphic designer for Cheap Ass Games, so I do all of the final layouts and, you know, how big is the type and where are the text boxes and all that. I'm always in the middle of a conversation with an artist about the distinction between art and graphic design. Like, you can make a very pretty picture, but the type you've chosen is illegible and you need to work on that, or just give it to me and let me do it. But so I think art is incredibly critical. Not only does the art tell the story, but also it can't get in the way of playing the game. And I've played plenty of games where it's a dark room or I'm too far away from the cards and I just can't read them, and it drives me crazy. The type is either too small or the font is too complicated or whatever. And so, like, that's a huge element of enjoying the games. I play a lot of playtest games. In fact, probably I play more unfinished games than finished games. And so I'm sort of acutely aware of what really bad graphic design will do to me. I just can't get interested in a game if I can't read it. So I encourage all of my friends to, like, you know, please take a minute, pick a bigger font for this, and then print it again.
You had a game, Before I Kill You, Mr. Bond, which is a card game inspired by James Bond. Was there there's a cease and desist order from MGM, so that was taken out of print. Is it accessible?
Yeah, not quite.
It was accessible online if someone wants to get a copy, but you're not allowed to put it out in with your label.
Yeah, sort of. I'll tell you my version of that. So we did a game called Before I Kill You, Mr. Bond. That was game number two. Way back in late 1996, and we were trying everything. And this particular one, it's a game where you're all supervillains and you are trapping lots of spies in your secret lair and either killing them or bragging and then killing them for bonus points. Very simple game. Doesn't really derive anything from the James Bond franchise per se. It's more like it's the same kind of spy game joke that all the Austin Powers movies are. But after that game was out for like 7 years, we got a letter from MGM that was basically like, look, man, we have to shut you down. It's funny, but we got to make you stop. And we were like, yeah, that's okay. We'll stop. So we actually did a contest to rename it. The winner of the contest was What Part of Dr. No Don't You Understand? So we couldn't use that. We redid it as the totally renamed spy game. And then that went out of print. And only recently, like 2 years ago, we brought that game back out in very close to its original form factor. And it's called Before I Kill You, Mr. Spy now. So same game, one word changed.
Cheap Ass Games has put out some Kickstarter campaigns to reprint previous games, such as Unexploded Cow. What have been some of your most recent Kickstarter projects?
The one we just finished is called Button Men, and that is a two-player dice game where the characters used to be sold as pinback buttons, but we decided to try a new format for that game, and we're doing the characters on trading cards because that makes them much cheaper. So, ideally in the future, what used to be the price of two characters is going to be the price of 12 characters, but this core set actually has 48 characters in it, and includes a lot of dice so that if you're stranded on a desert island or ordering the game online, that you at least have the dice to play the game. So it was an experiment for us. We like it. We have a bunch of new art. I still want to see how well it does in retail, because ideally we will get a lot of partners who can make their own expansion sets. That's what we did when Button Men was new 17 years ago, and get a lot more people playing and seeing this game. So that was our most recent one, and that was following the TAC campaign, which was a year ago. We haven't done anything else in the meantime. TAC sort of ate up a whole year of us making and shipping it, and I actually have a wood shop now because of TAC, because I needed to prototype the pieces much faster than my factory was able to do it. I needed to, okay, how big of a bag do I have to order for these parts, and how big should these parts be, and so on. So now I have a wood shop, and this weekend I'm actually going to make another tax set.
You have a game, Lord of the Fries, and this is inspired by a food. Each person gets a card that's inspired by a food item, and
it's zombies.
The goal,
right?
Is to complete. Yeah, they're like zombies, and but I guess the goal of this is to complete the menu item.
Yeah, that's right. So Lord of the Fries is the sequel to Give Me the Brain. Give Me the Brain was the original zombie fast food game in our world anyway. And the theme of the original was that you're all zombies working at a fast food restaurant and you only have one brain to pass around. So you have to get your work done and you have to get your hands on the brain in order to get your work done. It's kind of like the witches with the eye in Clash of the Titans, you know, who only have the one eye to pass around. So those zombies are great characters, and the sequel game is Lord of the Fries, is the one you're talking about, which doesn't really focus on how dumb they are. It just sort of focuses on the basics of working in a fast food restaurant, where you have an order that is comprised of several ingredients, and you're just trying to put those ingredients together in your hand. You pass cards around the table, you play orders, you decide what the next order is, and so on until you've until someone's out of cards. Very simple game, lots of fun, and we did recently kickstart that with the stretch goals being new decks. So in the olden days, we would do lots of new menus for the same set of ingredients. But in the new edition, we actually have additional decks that have whole new artwork and new ingredients. So there's a Mexican deck and a Chinese deck and a couple others that came out with the first wave. And we do have the artwork for four more of them, but I have still failed to get them on the production schedule.
As we were talking about the artwork, you also have a custom-made artwork coins for your game, Pennywise.
We haven't made custom Pennywise coins. We did some graphic versions. If you go to the website, if you go to cheapass.com, you're going to see dozens of free games. There are free versions of our old published games and some other just games that have always been free, like Pennywise. And yeah, the Pennywise file, I think, contains designs for what are basically poker chips of denominations like 1, 2, and 3, and 5, and 10, and whatever. I don't think we ever manufactured those, except in really short runs, though.
I find this interesting. Looking over your history on Board Game Geek and the games you've designed, some of them can get very pulpy, like American Idol, CCG, Looney Tunes, CCG, Sailor Moon Crystal Dice Challenge.
The Sailor Moon Crystal Dice Challenge is actually just coming out, and that's another Button Men expansion. That's like the same game, but in that format. So that's pretty cool. They're shipping about the same time we are.
Interesting. I mean, when you make these games, do you sometimes make them very quickly and move on to the next, or do you have like thought into them, like such as Button Men, or what is kind of the history of making commercial games that were just for sell or novelty purposes?
Yeah, you know, I mean, everyone is different. I could tell you the story of those individual games, but everyone is different. And to say that I put more thought into Button Men is probably wrong. Button Men just came easy. But like, so the Looney Tunes collectible card game, Wizards of the Coast approached me to do that game freelance. They said, you know, we're overtaxed. Our R&D guys want to work on grown-up games, and you seem like you can do infantile stuff, so why don't you work on this? And, of course, I love Looney Tunes. So I wrote, essentially, a trick-taking trading card game. It was a game that you could, obviously build your own deck, but it was a real simple, like finish a scene by playing the right cards kind of game. After I turned that in, they decided that they wanted to nerf it. They wanted to take about half the rules out because they decided their audience was much younger than the bracket that they had given me. I think they gave me like 8 to 14, and then they took it in-house and said, actually, how about just 6 to 8? So the game that came out has my name on it, but it only has about half the rules I gave them, and not necessarily the right half. That's frustrating as a designer, because like I never really saw the intermediate stages between when I turned it over and when it went out.
Your most recent game is Brawl. When was this released? This one does the illustrations. You can definitely see they're kind of anime influenced.
Yeah. We did kickstart Brawl about a year and a half ago, actually. And It was a reprint, an exact reprint of a game we did in 1999. 99 is kind of a golden year. Every time I think, what games are we doing? It was that year, but it's a real-time two-player combat game. So each player has their own deck, and the deck represents a character, and you're playing cards.
So is this sort of inspired by the older video games like Mortal Kombat?
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. That's exactly what it is. It's meant to be. In fact, the advertising at the time was it's faster than a video game. You play a game Brawl in about 30 seconds. You're playing cards to try to dominate the middle. There's target cards in the middle, and you want to have more hits on your side. Really simple mechanics, obviously, because you're playing as fast as you can. And the art on that is really good. There is the new edition of Brawl has the original art, slightly updated graphic design, and recently we've also posted. We haven't mass produced, but we posted it at Drive Through Cards. You can also get the seniors, which is six new decks that were created because we did so well with that campaign. We haven't mass produced the seniors yet, unfortunately.
That reminds me of Falling, like with when you're dealing the cards out, and that seems like a very quick game. When I first played that, that was a very straightforward game.
Yeah, and Falling is a precursor to Brawl, and Brawl, the innovation of Brawl was I figured out how to do it without a dealer. So Falling is a larger group. It has a dealer to distribute the cards and, you know, figure out fouls and who really should, you know, be right and wrong. Like, because everyone's going at the same time, the story of Falling is actually I was walking through the dealer's hall at Gen Con back when it was in Minneapolis and looking for essentially what wasn't there, but the idea came to me for the ad for the game. That was the absolute first thing I thought of for Falling was an image of the it's a mountain road, and there's a sign that says Falling Rocks, and someone, and I don't know how to draw this, but someone has fallen past the sign and added an exclamation point to it with a spray can as he went by. So Falling was like, okay, let's make a game about everyone falling and racing to hit the ground last. And that was the story. And how do I do that? And I sort of had to invent real-time card games to do this. I had played one real-time game prior to that. It was Andy Looney's Ice House game, which everyone is playing at once, but it's not super fast. It's tense because you're always on, but it's not like super, super fast. But I knew that let me know that such a thing was possible. And then I had been playing a lot of blackjack. And so that's sort of the format that we came up with was there is a dealer. And the dealer is giving cards to everybody else, and just in turn, one card for each. And then when the players get their cards, they decide what to do with them, and they become instructions for the dealer, and then you're asking for more cards, or skip me entirely, or whatever. And it does have a little tiny bit of blackjack feel to it, because like I said, that's kind of what it's based on. But yeah, that's super fun. And that's a game we have also recently redone. We got new art only because we wanted to add three cards to the game, and Brian Snowdy was not available to do those new cards, so we did a whole bunch of new Falling people.
I had the Goblin edition. I never had of Brian's art, but I really liked
it. Oh, yeah. Hey, Paizo did the Goblin edition of Falling for a while. There was this weird period for cheap-ass games when we were not just licensing some of our stuff out, but I was not printing anything. I went to work in the computer game industry for about 5 years and learned a lot. And then I came back and started doing this again.
This might sound interesting, but could you talk more about your relationship with the artist Philip Foglia and how long you've known each other? Because he seems to be a reoccurring. I love his art too, and I've been a fan of his.
Well, so Phil Foglia is a comic artist. He was well known long before I got started in this business, and he moved to Seattle in something like 1990 or 91. And at the time I was also like in the local comic scene. So it didn't take long for us to meet. And Phil and Kaya and my wife, Carol, and I were actually roommates for a couple of years when they bought a house. We were paying rent on one of their rooms. And so we have known them and been close with them for a very long time. That's prior to the initiation of Cheap Ass Games, actually. Like Magic the Gathering came out while we were living with Phil and Kaya, and they were doing art for Magic, and in fact, so was I, and I was writing for Wizards, and when I started publishing games, I'm always tapping Phil for, hey, can you illustrate this game for me? And we're continuing to do that. We're currently working on a very large art order, to about 200 new cards for Girl Genius The Works, which is a card game that we did together years ago, and we're updating it hopefully this year, maybe next year, whenever the schedule appears.
Where is homemade game designing going right now? What do you think about the state of the board game market, and how has that kind of affected the overall direction of your work?
Well, one of the things that has happened to printing over the last 20 years is that the old black and white format cheap-ass games that we used to do are just not doable anymore. It's frustrating. I keep wanting to figure out a way to bring back the black and white cheap-ass games, but I look at the costs. It's not paper and ink anymore. It's shipping. It's not color separations. It is paper. I mean, it's not color separations. It's not color. It's the things that that are the same whether I use one color of ink or four. I used to do short-run production at small local print shops. And small local print shops don't exist. Nobody needs printing the way they did 20 years ago. Everything is electronic. And so those smaller shops have been sucked up by larger shops or just simply gone out of business. And in order to make things really affordable, I would have to do high volumes and or do them in China where I have very little oversight or control over it. I just can't make it work. So that's one thing that's going on. But on the other side of that same process, people printing their own things is getting easier and easier, and print on demand is getting easier and easier. So a small inventor like myself, that is, if I'm not doing a game to be published, if I'm doing a game just for someone to play, I can put it up at a place like Drive-Through Cards that make really good playing card decks one at a time, and people can just order it straight from there. I don't carry inventory. The color control is great. Doing it in black and white is pointless unless it's for some sort of effect. But like this is a place where publishers can now, or inventors can now, publish their thing without any kind of risk. I mean, the other reason that there's less risk in publishing right now is Kickstarter. Everyone's raising their production budget before they go to press, which is great. But obviously that means that there's a lot of product in the marketplace, which means competing for shelf space at a retail store is now really, really hard. Typically, retailers will order a game once and never order it again. And you have to be on a very short list of evergreens to like keep a product in a store. So that's the challenge now in being in retail. It's not really a problem. I think the industry is growing, and I think that's good. But as an individual publisher, it can be very hard to rely on the success of an existing product. Like, good game or not, it's not going into the store again. Now all your sales are going to be done through Amazon or through Drive-Through Cards or whatever those long tail operations are.
You directed a short comedy film called The Man Between.
I did.
And it was filmed in multiple locations. You went all over the world, from like London to Las Vegas.
Now all over the English speaking world. Yeah. Not really that far. Well, so The Man Between was this project. You know, have you ever had a project you just have to do? Like, we have to do this. We have to do it right now. The idea was a spy in his off hours. There's this great scene in, I think it's Dr. No. Yeah, it's Dr. No, where we get to watch James Bond just sitting in a hotel room playing solitaire for hours waiting for the bad guy to show up and get shot, right? But more recent movies in that franchise assume that you know that's happening, and they cut all the action, right? They cut from one action scene to the next. So my friend Anthony and I decided, let's make this movie about a spy where everything in the movie is between the action scenes. That's the name of the reason for the name, The Man Between. And it turns out he's not all that great of a spy, because that was funnier. And Anthony is a game industry guy just like me, and we were going to a lot of the same conventions that year, and we just said, okay, let's do it now. We were all over the U.S., and we went to London as well and a couple of other places in the U.K. and shot essentially vignettes. Like, there's not really much of a story thread that holds this thing together, but it's 30 minutes of little comedy shorts about this spy and, you know, He's getting his head bashed against a dumpster, and then him and the bad guy sort of stop for a breather and start talking about Justin Timberlake, and it's just, you know, funny.
Oh, and it's also, there is a website, The Man Between, and it's available for download online as well.
Yeah, you can. I really. I don't know exactly where that stands, but yeah, by all means, go find it.
I was just interested in this. I think I read this in the Kobold's game design book. Are you still a fan of Killer Bunnies for the Quest of the Magic Carrot, or do you actually hate it?
So I don't think I want to play it again.
I'm a huge fan.
Killer Bunnies is that sort of game for non-gamers where the jokes are only funny the first time through. So it's very important, I think, to play it. And it's important as a game designer to watch people enjoy it because you kind of forget what fun means. But personally, I don't think I want to play it again. And I know that sounds like I'm trash talking it, and I'm not. I think Killer Bunnies is one of those great products that brings in a lot of money for a publisher that's kind of embarrassed about it. Like, I sort of feel that Munchkin is that way for Steve Jackson too. And I'm just guessing, I don't know, but like they make so much money on that game and it's so bad.
I love it because it basically just made me learn that it's not really about the end goal. It's about playing the game. I remember introducing the game to some friends at college and they're like, "What a great game. This is so amazing. How do you win?" It's a lottery. And they're like, "What?" Yep, and then it's this.
Yeah, exactly. And like, and that's really important to, for a game designer to acknowledge. Like, we take ourselves so seriously, and we look at the game mechanic of Killer Bunnies, and yeah, you're trying to accumulate lottery tickets. It's like the most frustrating end game from a design standpoint. But yes, it is all about the journey. It's not about who wins or how you or where you go, where you wind up. So, like, let it go. We've got a great story about in our design group. A friend of mine, Rick, was at Christmas with his family, and his nieces said, "Let's play Monopoly." And he said, "That game never ends." And they say, "You don't finish Monopoly, you just play it." Like, they have a whole different concept of where the fun is. And of course, they're right. We're just too tied up in it.
What do you think about the game Cosmic Encounter? Would you say that's an influence on you, or do you have any? I love Cosmic Encounter, but I always found that be a deep influence within the... We had them on the show, Peter Lokta, Greg, and Bill. I find Cosmic Encounter, I always have many different editions of that game, and if I was to play one board game forever... Like, remember that episode of Futurama where the world ends on Y2K and they play Dungeons & Dragons forever in that white spaceless void? And I think I would play Cosmic forever in that white spaceless void.
I don't think it's a direct influence. I think I probably played Cosmic once when I was growing up. I think it's an indirect influence because I learned a lot about game design from Magic the Gathering. And so that game draws a lot from Cosmic and Wiz War. And so, yeah, by the generations, the answer is yes, but not directly.
Mm. Would you ever consider doing a reissue of the game Xenophile?
Well, we just talked about it, actually. The mechanic of Xenophile is the same as the mechanic of Girl Genius. It's just that Girl Genius, the works, is an all-ages game, and Xenophile was for adults. In fact, Phil doesn't work on Xenophile.
Xenophile, the spelling is XXX.
Yeah. Yeah, it was an X-rated comic by Phil Folio, and it became an R-rated trading card game by Phil Folio. And this was back before there was a cheap-ass games, but only slightly. It's a great game mechanic, but it's not a pornographic game mechanic. So we repurposed it for Girl Genius the Works, and so it lives on in that form. I don't know. I think if you wanted to ask anyone if Xenophile was going to be republished, you'd have to ask Phil.
How would you describe the way the whole narrative and premise of that game?
Well, so first I'll tell you the game we didn't write. Trading card games were fairly new, and I was being frustrated at the time by how similar each one of them was to Magic. Like, everything is more derivative than it needs to be. And I think recently I joked it's kind of like a whole sequence of movies where Ed Norton is secretly Brad Pitt. Like, it was just really specifically copies. And one of the things I didn't like about trading card games as they were that they were based on combat. They were about fighting. And if you're going to make a game about people having sex, it can't really be combat based. So the first game that we came up with, the first concept we came up with was that both players are trying to build a birdhouse. It's a weekend. You've got some time off. You're trying to build a birdhouse. And the first person to do that wins the game. But you keep sending distractions over to your neighbor's house to keep him from getting any work done. that was a good story. It didn't turn into a good game mechanic. So we went back to the drawing board. And the mechanic of the actual published game, and it's similar to the mechanic in the works, is that you have a tableau of 12 cards, some from each player's deck, and they're lying in kind of a basket weave square. The edges where they touch show that those cards are interacting in some way, and when they interact in the right way, a card pops out and does a special ability. So I'm always like tinkering with the board. If you think about it in Girl Genius terms, it's like a big machine where all the gears are turning and gears are popping out and doing stuff. It's a puzzle game. It's very much a puzzle game where the goal is just to score as many points by getting the cards to pop out of the board.
We are at the end of the show. Before I wrap things up, James Ernest, do you have any upcoming projects that you want to plug?
Let's see. I'm going to the summer shows. We're going to be at Origins very shortly, and we'll have a big booth at Gen Con where we'll be selling TAC. We'll have a photo booth where you can get your picture taken with Dr. Lucky. BJ Becker is going to be there in full garb, and some of our other murderers as well. This fall, we're coming out with a Dr. Lucky expansion board called Dr. Lucky's Mansion That Is Haunted, where you get to play ghosts, trying to kill Dr. Lucky because you love him so much, you want him to stay with you forever. And Button Men is shipping in August, or excuse me, October as well. Button Men's our new version of an old dice game that's super intellectual for a game that uses 10 dice and takes 9 turns.
I just remembered something that I was in a board game club in college too, and I remember there was this one group of kids that would be obsessed with this war game. They wouldn't play Warhammer, but they would play this game where they punch out this cardboard and they were pirate ships. I think that game was designed by you. It's Pirates of the it's not losing my mind here. I think it's Pirates of the Spanish Main, right?
And yeah, so that's right. Pirates of the Spanish Main. I mean, if you want to have a little more tape, I can happily give you the story.
Give you a story on that, because I find it, because it's just been on my mind. And
So Pirates of the Spanish Main, they weren't cardboard, they were plastic, and basically like credit card plastic, a little bit thicker. Polystyrene is the official term for what it is. There was an import company called Z Cards that made these little plastic polystyrene models for a few years, and they were pretty cool. And in fact, they even did a trading card style game with their Z Cards, but it never really caught on. But we knew that it was possible. Let's make these are great miniatures, and they're sort of cheap once you make them the dies for them. So Jordan Weissman came up to me at Gen Con one year and he said, "Hey, I didn't know you did freelance work. Do you want to do a pirate game for me?" I said, "Sure." And all we knew was it was going to be polystyrene and it was going to be pirates. And he thought it was going to be Pirates of the Caribbean, but it took him longer than he expected to get that license. So we just did it without a license. And I took a look at the polystyrene models and I said, "Well, these make better ships than people. We don't really want to make a unit, or you don't want to make a unit a person because they make ugly people. You want to make a unit a ship." So we actually did the first, as far as I know, the first polystyrene models that have bent pieces, because the hulls of those ships are actually held together in a bent shape by the deck. I worked on that game that year, and for the sort of last get us over the home stretch part, because they decided that we had to write all the backstory, and that's not what I was originally hired for, I hired Mike Selinker to help me write the backstory and, you know, fill out the universe of ships. So Mike and I are the co-designers of Spanish Main, and that game did super well. Eventually they did get the Pirates of the Caribbean license, so there's some versions of it with that on it. It managed to stay afloat for probably 4 or 5 years, many, many expansions. It was a big seller in Target and all through the game industry. And you can now find some of those expansions really, really cheap.
Exactly.
The models themselves are cool. Even if you don't play the game, the models are cool. And I can say this because it's out of print now, but like there are now a lot of things that I would change about that game. And in fact, my group were playing a version of Spanish Main that was sort of a homebrew kit bash. And we just said, we threw it out and we started working on a new game, which I called Cagway Bay. And I've been working on that for about 5 years. But this year, John Wick Enterprises came to me and said, "Do you have a pirate game?" And I said, "Oh my God, yes." So we are now working on Cagway Bay, transforming it into a 7th Sea miniatures game, which is going to be an open this summer. and it will probably be kickstarted next spring. We're going to be showing that off at Origins, actually, at the John Wick booth, so come by and play that.
I've always been curious because my friends were super obsessed with, and because how cheap it was, and it kind of was this alternative war game, but I never got into it, but I knew about 8 people totally obsessed with that a few years ago. But that's very interesting.
Yeah, and it has a big following still. If you go to Board Game Geek, and search for me, that's what I do, about half the threads about my games are people doing game reports for Spanish Main. So like, they are still playing the heck out of that game.
James Ernest, I would like to thank you for being on. It's been an excellent show.
Thanks for having me.
And also, thanks, Pillator.
It's wonderful talking to you, James.
Yeah, you too. Thanks for having me on, man.